listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Sunday, May 21st. Support for this reading comes from the DuPaco R.W. Heffer Foundation. I'm Jackie.
I'm Pat.
And here is our first story.
Dubuque's homeless residents share their experiences in their own words. Many members of Dubuque's homeless population will attest that most people just don't grasp their situation. "We don't all got it like other people got it," said Albinaldi Santos. "You got to put yourself in other people's shoes." Local agencies recently have reported an apparent rise in homelessness in Dubuque, based on both demand for area services and formal counts conducted in coordination with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The annual point-in-time count conducted by Community Services Solutions of Eastern Iowa in January found 16 unsheltered residents in the city, more than double the 7 counted last year. More broadly, largely rural areas such as Dubuque County saw a 6% increase in the total number of homeless people from 2020 to 2022, according to HUD's annual homeless assessment report. Officials have noted many factors that have contributed to the rise in homelessness, such as the rising cost and decreasing availability of housing, loss of income in the wake of COVID-19 pandemic, and an increased prevalence of mental health conditions, among others. What the data points don't show, however, is the lived experience of those who experience homelessness in Dubuque. The city of Dubuque is an influx point for people who are unhoused and housing insecure throughout the area, largely due to its relative abundance of privately run social services offering housing and regular meals. Along with the emergency men's shelter at Dubuque Rescue Mission, the city has shelters for women and survivors of domestic violence and sexual abuse, as well as Almost Home, one of the few shelters in the country specifically aimed at men with children. A broad network of local congregations and nonprofits work in conjunction to feed people of all stripes. The Telegraph Herald spoke with several local residents experiencing homelessness about their backgrounds, daily lives, and what it is like to be homeless in Dubuque. The residents come from a variety of backgrounds. Some have experienced housing insecurity their entire lives. Others enjoyed relatively stable existences until unforeseen factors compromised their livelihood, mental health, or living conditions, sometimes all at once. Most residents interviewed for this story lived in Dubuque for some time before becoming homeless. Santos was born outside the United States, but has lived in the country since age 4. Some people provided their full names and allowed the Telegraph Herald to photograph them. Others declined to be photographed or requested that only their first name be used. Here is what they had to say about their experiences. "How did you last find yourself homeless?" Abinaldi Santos, 22, lives at Dubuque Rescue Mission. "I ended up in a hospital for suicide and didn't have anywhere to go, so I went to Hillcrest Family Services. Then I went to Mount Pleasant Home. Then I didn't have any money for rent, so I came here." Brianna Wilder, age 27, squatting in a Dubuque apartment at time of interview. "I was talking to a girl. I came up here from Columbus, Ohio, to try and be with her. I've been helping her with her kids, doing household stuff, and then she ran off on me. So she left me in a situation where I don't have no money, no nothing. She even left her two cats with me. I'm trying to get to the Humane Society to drop them off. Chris, 19, lives outdoors in Dubuque. I was terminated from my job 2 months before COVID started. I received unemployment for a year. I got $2,500 of unemployment, and then they changed their mind. That's wrong. And then I was evicted, and then I ended up here on the street. Beverly, 62, lives outdoors in Dubuque. My husband passed away, and I sold the house. That property only got me 4 years of income, and nobody will hire a cripple. Randy Snyder, 62, lives at Dubuque Rescue Mission. To make a long story short, I've been dealing with alcohol problems for years. I got sober for a year and a half, and then I fall off the wagon. 9 months here, 6 months here. The last time I was out of the rescue mission for 3 months, and I didn't actually get evicted. I just didn't get my lease renewed. Samantha Peterson, 34. Unhoused at time of interview, now lives in Teresa Shelter in Dubuque. I was living in my apartment, and I was dealing with some harassment in the building, so I did not pay my rent. My friend recently pled guilty to federal drug charges and received 7 years. He was innocent of some of the things he was charged with, and the people harassing me did not like that I defended him and told on them. Have you experienced housing insecurity in the past? Snyder. I was thinking about that yesterday when I came here. How many times I've been at the mission. Moved here in 2010, and I've probably been here 4 times, maybe 5. I didn't really lose control of things until probably 2006. I was working at a place for like 14 years, and then they shut the plant down. I worked at a place that made mobile home frames, and you know, there was the housing problem back then and the mortgages. In 4 years, I went through my 401k, living on the side jobs, painting barns, stuff like that. What does daily life look like for you right now? Beverly, I spend a lot of time trying to charge my wheelchair because the charger goes bad. They're bringing me a new one tomorrow. Snyder, I've been trying to get my physical self back into shape. I'm just now feeling a little more sure of myself, because when you go on a bender with hard alcohol at my age, it kind of drains you out. Now I'm just working around the mission, cleaning, trying to get my head straight. Chris, I've been trying to start applying for jobs to the library. Apply through the computer. I can't run a computer. I was born before that. Every day is trying to hustle a buck, get a cigarette. Peterson, I've had my cat with me, Pixie. We've kind of been wandering around all day, and then I wait until a little bit later at night to sleep on the police station floor, on the lobby. I'm able to let my cat out in places where people don't really go in and out, so she can roam and doesn't have to be stuck in a cage. How does the Dubuque community treat you as a homeless person? Chris, the housing authority doesn't do much. They've got a housing choice voucher program, second Tuesday of every month. You have to have it in there to apply to be on the wait list. I did it today, but you have to have it in again the same time next year. Beverly, the police and residents are good. City staff is both because they want to kick us all out. I got kicked out of the parking area. After that, I went over to the Mission Garden. They couldn't touch me there. The city doesn't want to do anything to help us. We're an eyesore. What's the biggest challenge you face? Snyder, staying sober. That's pretty much the bottom line. Beverly, for me, it would be the bathrooms because they lock the bathrooms and the parking ramps and we can't use them. Well, they do that for everybody. But I have to run down to the okie-dokie or someplace. Who has helped you get by? Beverly. Here, the rescue mission, the police. They brought me food, made sure I had blankets if I needed them, a place to stay. Snyder. People that have helped me at the rescue mission, the staff. There's a lady who used to work here. She's a friend. Her and her husband, they've actually helped me quite a bit. She's always there to help me. They own some rental properties, and if they need anything done like that, they'll call me. They're just supportive like that. What don't people get about being homeless? Santos. Just think we're bums and don't want to do things. But it's like, I want to be moving. I want to get food and some money and an apartment and a girl. I don't want to live like this. Beverly. They don't get the fact that we're homeless. We can't pack it up and go home. The city said there's a homeless problem, and then they try to push us out instead of help us out. What are your plans for the future? My next step would be to get an apartment without having to pay for it. The state can pay for it. Then I can get a job and pay for a percentage. Santos. I'm about to leave in a week or two. I'm going to go to a group home and then get my own apartment. Peterson. I'm just trying to do something with myself, whether that's to go to school, get a house. I really want to do something with law enforcement in the realm of working with people in corrections or a substance abuse counselor and being able to help people who are homeless and addicted to drugs. I want to help people reintegrate.
Gronin. City has hindered development. Local developer says he is seeking a more positive relationship with Dubuque leaders after sending a letter to address concerns. By John Cruz. A letter sent by a prominent local developer to City of Dubuque leaders claims the actions of city government have contributed to multiple business development being canceled or delayed. The letter sent on April 26th by John Gronin, president of local development company Gronin, was obtained by the Telegraph Herald through a Freedom of Information Act request and includes the revelation that hospitality company Margaritaville at one point was holding negotiations to develop a resort in Dubuque. However, the project eventually was canceled. City manager Mike Van Milligan said he and other city staff take the criticisms outlined in the letter seriously and are actively working to implement measures to address them, though he could not specify what those actions will be. Quote, "We would suggest that we are always looking to improve," Van Milligan said. "Any feedback we can get, we are all for that." Speaking with Telegraph Herald, Gronin said he sent the letter on behalf of numerous business owners and nonprofit leaders to address ongoing concerns with the city, but he now is focused on building a more positive relationship with city staff. The way to make this work is through strong private and public partnership, he said. We feel that candor is the highest form of respect that we can show. We felt there needed to be a level set. The letter. In his letter addressed to Van Milligan, Mayor Brad Kavanaugh, and Dubuque City Council, Gronin states that he is writing on behalf of a group of concerned citizens in response to a significant and debilitating change in tone from our city government. Gronin's letter lists a number of alleged behaviors city leadership has exhibited toward business owners and developers. The list is as follows. 1. Adversarial discussions with a multitude of developers. 2. Overuse of leverage. 3. Lack of willingness to find a way to yes. 4. At times, unresponsiveness and unempowered city staff. 5. Shifting of the financial liability from the city to developers. 6. Creating unnecessary hurdles. And 7. Changing the ground rules after they have already been established. Asked to provide further clarification about some of the listed concerns, Gronin declined and stressed that his focus was on having positive conversations with the city about the future. "We are engaged in constructive conversations," he said. "It's ongoing, and there is work being done as we speak." Gronin's letter also lists several development deals he says failed to materialize, writing that an examination of those failures would provide an excellent after-action opportunity. "Let's resurrect these projects, identify the obstacles, and get people back to the table," the letter states. The listed developments are 1. Margaritaville, Grand River, 2. FedEx, 3. Weber Property, 4. Yardarm, and 5. Joel Callahan. Another project referred to as Tony Fole Project, Cypel Road, is noted in the letter as having taken an inordinate amount of time to resolve. Gronin declined to speak further on the projects listed in his letter. Gronin also wrote in the letter that a 5-year business growth plan facilitated by an outside consultant is critically important. "We would invite the city in as a participant, but believe this needs to be an unbiased, critical look at all things Dubuque." The letter states, "Discussions with potential consulting firms have already begun." Gronin's letter lists action steps that include a meeting to discuss projects with the goal of removing barriers, development of an authentic development roundtable for unvarnished discussions to move projects forward, and creation of a platform for members of the business community to advocate for support for projects that will strengthen the local economy. Gronin said he already has begun discussions with city officials and believes things are heading in the right direction. The letter notes a positive conversation with Van Milligan in early April. Van Milligan said he has not met with Gronin since the letter was sent to the city in late April. Rick Dickinson, president and CEO of Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, said he believes the city typically does a good job navigating business development deals. "When you're in city government, as it relates to economic development, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't," he said. "Taxpayers are concerned about how their dollars are spent. Developers want the best deal they can get from the city. City staff have many factors to weigh in every project. Sometimes projects happen and sometimes they don't. You can have everything the prospect wants put in place, and sometimes the deal still doesn't come together because it's just a very competitive process." Kavanaugh said he is open to discussing ways the city can improve its relationship with local businesses, but he rejected any assertions the city has worked against business developments. "We have done quite a few development agreements just recently around housing," Kavanaugh said. "I don't think a blanket statement that the city is against development is an accurate one." A memo Van Milligan sent last week to officials in the city's economic development, housing, planning services, and engineering departments details the city's successes related to housing, industrial, and other development projects. The memo notes that programs aimed at supporting housing creation have brought $42 million in grant funds into downtown redevelopment and housing creation in the past 5 years, along with $34 million in tax increment financing grants. The city also has committed about $31 million since 2016 for projects aimed at job creation and development of commercial properties, leveraging more than $225 million in private investment, the memo states. The city also has invested tens of millions of dollars in the development of industrial parks, with more budgeted. Status of developments. In noting the concerns of local business owners, Gronin points to multiple developments he says failed to materialize. Van Milligan declined to provide further details on any of the listed developments. However, the Telegraph Herald was able to obtain information about some of them and previously has reported moves related to other ones. Regarding Margaritaville, reached by the Telegraph Herald on Thursday, Sue Moran, general manager of Grand Harbor Resort in Dubuque, confirmed that a developer had begun negotiations last summer to purchase the hotel with plans of converting it into a Margaritaville resort, but she declined to elaborate on why the development failed to come to fruition. Dickinson said Greater Dubuque Development eventually was brought in by Grand Harbor Resort leadership to assist with the negotiations, but by then, the project already was deemed unlikely to proceed. We were asked to be brought in when things seemed to be falling apart, Dickinson said. Representatives with Margaritaville declined to comment for this story. The FedEx project. In 2021, it was announced that a developer planned to build a $22.5 million distribution center in Dubuque to be leased by FedEx Ground Package System. The facility was to be built adjacent to the company's current facility on Innovation Drive and add 10 new jobs to its workforce. As part of the development, the city agreed to sell a 34-acre property also on Innovation Drive for $5.1 million to Setzer Properties Dubuque LLC, which would build the facility for FedEx. In February 2022, however, City Council members voted to terminate the development agreement with Setzer Properties. At the time, Van Milligan stated that the project was canceled after officials had determined Setzer had not secured a lease agreement with FedEx and that other companies were competing to build the new facility for FedEx. A new FedEx facility has not been built. Reached by the Telegraph Herald, representatives with FedEx declined to comment. The Weber property. In late 2021, City Council members voted to spend $4.2 million to purchase 156 acres located northwest of the Southwest Arterial and US 61 intersection to create a new industrial park. The project included the hiring of Origin Design to draft site plans for the property, with plans of having a 30-acre parcel ready for business development as soon as possible. Van Milligan previously stated that the city had anticipated a business would develop on the site, but the company later informed city staff it was not ready to move forward with the project. As a result, city officials put development of infrastructure at the site on hold. The Yardarm Project. Yardarm Riverfront Bar and Grill is located in Dubuque on Shiras Avenue and is part of Dubuque Marina. It was not clear what development the letter was referring to, and officials with the business declined to comment. Joel Callahan Project. Joel Callahan is the founder and president of Callahan Construction Incorporated. Callahan began work in 2021 on developing a 56-unit apartment complex off of Buys Drive. Speaking with the Telegraph Herald, Callahan said he has experienced multiple issues with city staff that have led to the project's delay. "We had to deal with everything listed in that letter," Callahan said, referring to Gronin's letter to the city. "That hits our experience to the T." Early on, Callahan said, he ran into disagreements with the city over the reconstruction of the intersection of Bias Drive, Sylvan Drive, Century Circle, and Century Drive. He said a design for the reconstruction would have caused new portions of road to encroach farther into his property, though the intersection eventually was redesigned so as not to encroach on his land. Callahan said he also experienced issues with changes in electrical wiring regulations enacted by the city. On December 20, 2021, the city adopted local amendments to its National Electric Code, one of which prohibited the installation of Romex cable in multifamily residential construction above the second floor. Callahan said this code change was made while he was in the midst of developing his apartment project, and as a result, increased the project cost by about $80,000. "I told them that I ain't doing that," Callahan said. "It was like another roadblock that they threw out in front of us." At the May 15th City Council meeting, however, council members voted to revise the city's electrical code, allowing Romex cable to be installed in multifamily residential construction above the second floor. As a result, Callahan said, he now plans to move forward with his apartment project. City officials wrote in a statement to the TH that they plan to contact Callahan to try and get a better understanding of his specific concerns. "The city must consider the individual requests of developers and balance those requests with its public safety and public benefit responsibilities," the statement reads. "Individual developers can focus on their property and project, but the city must consider each project's impact on surrounding properties, roadways, and the entire community." The statement also notes the recent update to the city electrical code. "It is our understanding that a code change like this could save projects similar in size to Mr. Callahan's tens of thousands of dollars," the statement reads. And the Tony Fole project. Tony Fole is general manager of the Fisher Companies. Reached by the Telegraph Herald, Fole declined to comment on the project named in Gronin's letter.
Local party leaders, Politico, share Iowa caucus expectations, by Benjamin Fisher. Republican president candidate Nikki Haley's Dubuque campaign stopped last week ahead of the 2024 Iowa caucus made it seem like the same quadrennial political tradition Iowans have come to know and love. But looks can be deceiving. Ahead of Haley's event, area caucus enthusiasts shared a host of changes and concerns that could make this season more different than all the patriotic bunting and yard signs might suggest. The most obvious difference to date is that, at least so far, the parade of candidates crisscrossing the state will be one-sided, since the Democratic National Committee maintains their plan to ditch Iowa for South Carolina as the first primary state in the nation. Loras College political scientist Professor Chris Budzis said that some impacts of that difference would be more noticeable than others. We have become really accustomed to both parties running their caucus simultaneously, he said. But people are going to notice eventually, this cycle, that they're not seeing slates of candidates from both sides. Instead of hullabaloo coming from both parties, it will be a swirl of more of the same faces more often. Although since you have an incumbent, President Joe Biden, for Democrats, there may not have been as much activity for them anyway. Biden does have two primary opponents, of course, two authors with unorthodox views, Marianne Williamson, who ran in 2020, and Robert Kennedy Jr. But unless the Iowa Democratic Party makes a surprise win in their stalemate with the DNC, Budzis said they are unlikely to appear in Iowa. The most notable result of the change for the average Iowan, Budzis says, would be decreased volume in the caucus season and blitz din. People are going to eventually realize they're seeing and hearing fewer advertisements than in previous cycles, with primary fields in both parties. Of course, for some Iowans, that might seem like a blessing more than anything. But for some businesses like newspapers, TV, and radio stations, billboard companies, and venues that might host events, that could hurt. County Democratic parties also could be hurt in 2024 caucus participation if the DNC keeps to its current path. But Dubuque County Democrats Chairman Matt Robinson said his team plan is to mitigate that drop by year-round outreach. We are going to have to figure out how to brand that this is still an important vote and that we need people to come out, he said. Then I believe the base voters will show up as needed for this caucus no matter what. Dubuque County Republican Party Chairman John Dara said that locals in the Republican Party of Iowa share concerns that Democrats with no first-in-the-nation caucus of their own might change their registration to Republican so that they can infiltrate and spoil the results of the Republican caucus.
You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader is Jackie.
Pat.
If you have any comments on this or any IRIS program, please call 243-6833 or toll free at 877-404-4747. And don't forget, this and many other IRIS programs are available from our website at iowaradioreading.org. Now, we return to the Telegraph Herald and today's obituaries. Judith A. Nimer. Judith A. Judy Kerper Nimer, age 83, of Dubuque, passed away at 8:13 a.m. on Friday, May 19th, 2023, at Stonehill Health Center. To honor Judy's life, family and friends may visit from 4 p.m. until 7 on Tuesday, May 23rd at Bear Funeral Home, where there will be a parish scripture wake service held at 6:45. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, May 24th at the Church of the Nativity, with Reverend Andrew Uppa, the officiating. Entombment will be in the Mount Calvary Cemetery Mausoleum. Judy was born on November 1, 1939, in Dubuque, daughter of John and Ellen Kerper. Judy graduated from Visitation Academy. She met the love of her life, Morris Nimer, at Catholic Singles Event. Maury walked up to her, saying that he had heard she was a pretty good bowler, and the challenge was on. The couple went on to marry on June 13, 1964, at St. Patrick's Church. They were blessed with 57 wonderful years of marriage, 5 sons, and several years of bowling together. Sadly, Judy lost her beloved Maury on February 16, 2022. She was a devoted wife and mom who volunteered her time in the Learning Center at Nativity School while the boys were attending school there. After the boys were raised, she went to work as a bookkeeper at Borley Advertising and the Visitation Convent for 30 years. Her faith was always an important aspect of her life and was evidenced by her longtime membership with the Church of the Nativity. Judy was quite the bowler and bowled in several leagues, including mixed league with Maury. She liked camping, fishing, and baking cookies. Judy was an incredible hostess. Her home was always the gathering place in the neighborhood when the boys were young, and she was always happy when their friends joined them. She loved having company and especially enjoyed visits from the grandchildren and her grand puppy, Annie. Every year, Judy made sure she signed up for the annual pass at the Mississippi River Museum so that she could take all of the grandchildren to visit. We will miss our sweet, wonderful mom and grandma tremendously, but know that she is now resting peacefully, reunited with her beloved Maury. Those left to cherish Judy's memory include her four sons, Kevin, Patrick, Jean, and Doug. Her grandchildren, Ben, Stephanie, Megan, Kaylee, Colin, Jeff, Noah, Sophia, Emma, and John, and numerous nieces and nephews. Judy was preceded in death by her parents, her loving husband Maury, a son Timothy, a sister Mary Tilmeny, and a brother John Kerper. Judy's family would like to thank all of the nurses and staff of Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital, Stonehill, and Hospice of Dubuque for the understanding care they have provided for Judy. The family will thankfully receive your support through greeting cards and memorials in Judy's memory, which may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com.
Yvonne E. Schreiner. Yvonne E. Bonnie Schreiner, age 90, of Dubuque, Iowa, completed her earthly journey on May 13, 2023 at Stonehill Care Center. To honor Bonnie's life, a private family service is being held. Bonnie's burial will be in the Mount Calvary Cemetery. Bonnie was born on February 28, 1933 in Dubuque, a daughter to Nicholas and Apollonia Thilm and Beale. She grew up with a devotion to family and friends that continued throughout her 90 years among us. She met and married her soulmate, James, and the two were inseparable from that moment. They would have celebrated their 70th wedding anniversary this August. And with Jim being called home in January of this year, we find peace in knowing they will be spending their anniversary together after all. Bonnie's commitment to her husband, children, and grandchildren was a testament to the reality that unrestrained love is truly a possibility in this world. In her early years, Bonnie always enjoyed her weekly bowling nights with her friends. After Jim retired, they were blessed to spend 19 years wintering together in Tampa, Florida. It utterly breaks our hearts beyond measure to lose Mom and Dad within months of each other, but we are forever grateful for the years, memories, and legacy they leave behind, and are proud to know that the Lord was kind enough to trust us being handed into their arms. Thank you, Bonnie, for all of the love that you so abundantly shared throughout our life, and may the Lord bless and keep you now as you and Jim walk in hand once again. Bonnie was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, her daughter, Jody, her two brothers, Leo, Bill, and her sister, Grace. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts, or other expressions of sympathy may be sent directly to Michelle Cornish at 2289 Martin Drive, Dubuque, Iowa. Bonnie's family would like to thank the nurses and staff at Stonehill Care Center and Hospice of Dubuque for all of their professional and compassionate care of Bonnie and her family. The few years that Mom and Dad have resided at Stonehill has truly exposed the importance of excellent staffing, along with the sincere devotion to their patients that is such a precious gift. Thank you to all of the nurses and staff who have cared for our parents, just as they would their own, and may God bless you for all your generosity and kindnesses.
Earl Rettenmeyer. Earl Rettenmeyer, 92, of Dubuque, died Thursday, May 18th, at home, surrounded by family. A prayer service will be held at 3 p.m. Tuesday, May 23rd, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home in Crematory, followed by visitation until 7 p.m. The Mass of Christian Burial for Earl will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 24th, at Holy Spirit Parish, Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with Father Stephen Garner as the celebrant. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Full military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post No. 6. Earl was born on January 22, 1931, on the family farm in Lower Balltown, Iowa, the son of Fred and Alvina Rettenmeyer. He married Marlene Lex on August 16, 1958. Earl went to grade school in Balltown and joined the Navy in 1953, serving until 1956. He was able to participate in the honor flight with his brother, Howard. In 2012, he worked 30 years at John Deere Dubuque Works, retiring in 1989. He was an active member of Local 94, serving as a union steward. As he prepared for his retirement, he became an inaugural kennel owner with his friend Joe Lent at Dubuque Greyhound Park. Earl was an active member at Sacred Heart, now Holy Spirit Parish, having worked on various committees including finance, fall festival, and renovation. He was a member of the American Legion Post No. 6. He was also on the grounds committee for the Dubuque Arboretum. Earl was an avid baseball fan, following the Brooklyn LA Dodgers, playing and managing for the Balltown semi-pro team, and coaching the Bulldogs Bears Independent League baseball team. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame for Dubuque County Baseball in 2011 and Independent League in 1986. Earl was a family man. In addition to coaching his sons in baseball, he loved snowmobiling in the winter and boating in the summer. He was also a lifelong fan of the Wallert Golden Eagles, attending most football, basketball, and baseball games over the past 50 years. He was a friend to many and will forever be remembered for his infectious cackling laugh. Survivors include his wife of 64 years, Marlene, children Ruth Gallo, Nancy Pape, Joe Rettenmeyer, and John Rettenmeyer, all of Dubuque, 6 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren, brother Howard Rettenmeyer, sisters Elaine Link and Mert Habel, and brothers and sisters-in-law Alan and Marianne Lex, Bob and Shirley Lex, and Carol and Janice Lex. He was preceded in death by his parents, sister Jeanette Slattery, father and mother-in-law Dan and Viola Lex, sisters-in-law Shirley Rettenmeyer, Rita Brimeyer, brother-in-law Gus Slattery, Jim Habel, Lyle Link, Jim Lex, Laverne Lex, and Willie Brimeyer. The family would like to extend a special thank you to Carol and Amy from Home Instead, Stonehill Care Center, Dr. Salas, and Dr. Horchek, hospice nurse Julie and his favorite nurse, daughter Ruth. In lieu of flowers, memorials have been established to Hospice of Dubuque and Holy Spirit Parish. A photo tribute can be viewed and condolences sent to the family by visiting Earl's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com.
Stephen T. Suppo, Cascade, Iowa. Stephen Steve Thomas Leo Suppo, age 76, died on May 17, 2023, due to complications of multi-myeloma with his family by his side. His celebration of life will be held Monday, May 22nd, with the wake from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. at St. Raphael Cathedral, where a mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. with Father Philip Thompson officiating. Private family burial will be held in Calvary Cemetery in Cascade. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, Dubuque, is assisting the family. Steve was born in Cascade, Iowa on December 24, 1946, to John and Kate Supple, joining his sister Jean, and to be joined by his brother Roger. He began his education in a one-room schoolhouse in Temple Hill, Iowa, in the third grade. He switched to St. Martin's, a school in Cascade, and met the love of his life, Jan Crowley. They attended and graduated from St. Thomas Aquinas High School in 1965. Steve went on to earn his bachelor's in agronomy from Iowa State University and was a Cyclone fan his entire life. Steve and Jan were married on June 1, 1968 at St. Martin's Church in Cascade. They farmed together in the Temple Hill area for four decades with their children, Jan and BJ. Steve believed in serving his community and those in it as soil commissioner of the Swiss Valley Board, Pork Producers, FFA, 4-H, his children's schools and sports teams, the CARE Foundation and St. Raphael's Cathedral. The center of his service was Camp Courageous, where he served as a board member, foundation board member, traffic director, cornhusker, sausage donator and cooker, tree stump remover, cook and server for campers. While he was involved at that camp with Jan by his side, some of the honors he received for his community service were the 9 Who Care Award, the J.C. Penney Award, and the Governor's Volunteer Award. Steve's dedication to serving his community was second to one thing, his love for his family. Steve adored and treasured his wife, Jan. He attended every one of his kids' activities, sometimes sitting by himself in the stands, because he came straight from the field and his farm crows were a little ripe. He was known as Pickin' Papa by his grandchildren, whom he delighted in dumping from the bucket of his loader into snowdrifts, teaching them to ride the gator and four-wheelers and watching them sing, act, and dance. He was deeply loved and will be sorely, deeply missed. Steve is survived by his wife, Jan, his sister, Jean, his brother, Roger, his daughter, Jen, and her children, Max, Miles, and Delilah, and his son, and his children, Charlie and Lucy. Steve's family would like to thank all those who supported Steve through his recent health challenges, especially the staff at Finley Hospital and Stonehill Health Center. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Camp Courageous of Iowa.
Karen A. Leeson. Karen Ann Heiser Leeson of Dubuque, Iowa, passed away peacefully at the age of 80 years due to ALS-related complications on Wednesday, May 17th. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 24th at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home. The Mass of Christian Burial for Karen will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, May 25th at Church of the Nativity. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery. Karen was born April 7, 1943 in Winona, Minnesota, the daughter of Ralph and Elizabeth Heiser. On December 4, 1965, she married Vincent Leeson of Plainview, Minnesota, at St. Mary's Catholic Church. In 1967, the couple moved to Dubuque, Iowa. Karen dedicated a great deal of time to the Church of the Nativity, filling many parish roles. She especially enjoyed her position as parish visitor, spending time with parishioners and keeping them connected to their church community. Karen was a dedicated volunteer, spending her time as 4-H leader, Boy Scout leader, Dubuque Symphony Orchestra greeter, Shalom Spirituality Center volunteer, Dubuque Youth Hockey Organization registrar and treasurer, and much more. An avid Dubuque Fighting Saints fan, Karen often sang the national anthem for games and housed multiple players over the years. She ran a home-based child daycare for nearly 40 years. She was co-owner and bookkeeper for Dubuque Appliance Center, the business co-founded by her husband Vince. In 1984, Karen enrolled at Loras College in Dubuque to finish earning the degree she started working towards 24 years earlier at the University of Minnesota. In May 2019, then 76-year-old Karen became the oldest graduating student in the 180-year history of Loras College, receiving her bachelor's degree. Karen is survived by her devoted husband Vince, her 9 beloved children, Jean Blondock, Teresa Sellinger, Stephen Leeson, Amy Ouellette, Daniel Leeson, Diana Maroney, Angela Seeley, Molly Leeson, and Anthony Leeson, her 23 cherished grandchildren. Karen is preceded in death by her parents and her father and mother-in-law, Joseph and Julia Leeson. A special thank you to the wonderful staff members of Bethany Home and Hospice of Dubuque for their incredible dedication and care. In lieu of flowers, a memorial has been established. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory is in care of the arrangements.
Adela E. Gleisman. Adela Elizabeth Gleisman, age 94, completed her earthly journey on May 18th with family by her side. Adela was born in the family farm in Lamont, Iowa, August 19, 1928, the daughter of Alfred and Amanda. After being friends since childhood, George Gleisman proposed to Adela at the stock car race in Maquoketa. Quite romantic way to go, Dad. Apparently, she said yes, and they were married, united in marriage, on October 21, 1951, at St. John's Lutheran. Together, they raised their children and farmed in Jackson County. She was a humble, faith-filled lady and a member of St. John's Lutheran Church all her life. Being that she was a very talented seamstress, Adela helped create many beautiful blankets for the church and her family. Each grandchild received their own handmade quilt. Losing her mother at 18 months of age, she learned the value of caring for others and how to become a fantastic cook at a very young age. Adela's legacy of love and grace lives on through her 5 children, William and Sherry, Emily, Van and their children, Josh, Jordan, John and Mary and their children, Ruth, great-grandchildren, and sister-in-law, Verena Daggetts. She was welcomed into heaven by her husband of 50 years, George, an infant son, Thomas, her parents, a brother, Paul, a sister, Mary, Kenneth and Thelma, Barry Daggetts, Kenstein. Friends may call from 3 to 7 Monday, May 22nd, at St. John's Lutheran Church in St. Donatus. Visitation will continue after 9 a.m. Tuesday, and a celebration of Adela's life will be held at 10:30 Tuesday. Burial to follow in Church Cemetery next to the man she loved. The family would like to express gratitude for the care given to our caretaker, to Dr. Cones and Nurse Sherry, Hospice, especially Julie, and the staff and Luther Manor. We love you, Mom.
That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for May 21st. I'm your reader, Jackie.
I'm Pat.
Support for this reading comes from DuPaco R.W. Heffer Foundation. The Telegraph Herald can be heard each weekday at 2 p.m. All programs heard on IRIS are intended solely for the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions or comments on this or any IRIS program, please call our office toll-free at 877-404-4747. Thanks for listening.